It was mid-afternoon when Sam Heller and Lydia Fisher reached Rancho Grande, one of the biggest spreads in the county, in all north central Texas for that matter. The ranch was bordered on the north by Old Mission Road, and on the south by the upper fork of the Liberty River. Before getting too deep into Grande land, Sam and Lydia were intercepted by a band of vaqueros who patrolled the lush grasslands to deter trespassers, rustlers, and marauders. Ranchmaster Don Eduardo Castillo had no love for intruders on his private domain, especially Anglos, all of whom he lumped under the label Texans, and whom he resented for what he felt was their steady encroachment on his land. The outriders closed in. Mexican Americans, they were hard men with grim, unfriendly faces under broad-brimmed sombreros and weapons, guns and rifles held at the ready. Lydia turned to Sam.
I heard the Grande riders shoot white folks on sight.
Not true. Just pesky yellow-haired gals with braids.
Lydia looked unsure as to whether or not he was joking. Sam was no stranger to the ranch, thanks to previous involvements with the Castillo clan. He was recognized by the jefe, the boss of the vaquero band. Sam spoke a few sentences to him in rough, broken Spanish, a language he was learning, but still a long way from mastering. He got his message across, though, especially the dreaded word Comanche. Of no less dread import was the name Mano Rojo, Red Hand. The jefe's face stiffened, his dark-eyed gaze hardening. Some of the vaqueros muttered curses. All checked their weapons and peered into the distance in search of war parties. Mexicans and Comanches had been mortal enemies for more than 300 years, since the first armor-shelled conquistadors ventured north from Mexico City across the Rio Grande. The rancho had battled for survival against the Comanches for over a century. The jefe issued a series of rapid-fire commands to his men, who leaped into action. One wheeled his mount, spurring it southward at top speed toward the rancho, hidden from view by some low ridges. He raced all out to give warning. Two more vaqueros peeled off from the group, pointing their horses in opposite directions, one going east, the other west, galloping away to spread the alert to other working parties tending the herds on the grazing lands. The jefe and those remaining escorted Sam and Lydia to the ranch. 20 minutes of hard riding brought them in sight of the main settlement. Here was the core, the inner citadel of Rancho Grande. A sizable tract of land was enclosed by thick adobe walls 10 feet tall. The walls were pocked and cratered by rounds fired in numerous battles, some old, others of more recent vintage. The main gate faced south. A set of stout, iron-bound, dark wooden double doors stood open, allowing a view within. Square-faced columns topped by an adobe arch bracketed the entrance. A bronze bell hung from a black iron chain in the center of the archway. A dirt road stretched across the flat, fronting the portal. Sam, Lydia, and their vaquero escort rode in under the arch, through the gate, and into a wide courtyard. Stung by the advance rider's warning, the ranchero was abuzz with activity, swift and purposeful. Within high, curved adobe walls, parapets accessed by stairways served as shooting platforms. Sentries on the walls scanned the horizon for sign of hostiles. None had yet appeared. Two-man teams toted crates of rifle ammunition, each man gripping a rope handle attached to a short end of the case. Laboring under the heavy load, they lugged the crates up the stairs onto the ramparts, broke open the lids with rifle butts, and began handing out boxes of cartridges. Riders rushed in and out of the main gate, going here and there on various vital errands. The dirt-floored outer courtyard gave way to the stone-paved inner courtyard of a plaza. At its center was a wide, shallow adobe water basin and fountain, fed by a well. Bordering the plaza were outbuildings, stables, a tool and equipment shed, and storehouses filled with supplies of corn and sides of dried, smoked meat. Beyond the fountain rose the main building, a three-story structure, an imposing edifice that fronted south. Its slanted roof was shingled with orange ceramic tiles. Across the whitewashed adobe and stucco front, black ironwork grills hung on the windows. Ornate rails and balustrades covered the second-floor balcony. Lush, extensive gardens and arcades lay on the west side of the building. The jefe escorted Sam and Lydia into the inner courtyard. They were met by Hector Vasquez, the segundo, the foreman of the ranch. He was topped by an outrageously oversized broad-brimmed sombrero, its tall crown narrowed to a curved peak, looking like an inverted horn of plenty. Spilling out from under was plenty of hombre, a bearish, barrel-chested, big-bellied man. A pear-shaped face was framed by masses of shaggy salt-and-pepper hair. Dark black eyes looked out from a bronzed visage whose cheekbones and cheeks were pitted by remnants of long-ago smallpox scars. He wore a black bolero jacket with silver trim and frogging, a white embroidered shirt whose front was strained by a massive swelling belly, black bell-bottom pants, and silver-trimmed leather boots. Worn low under his big gut was a pair of six guns and soft leather buscadero holsters.
He looks like a bandit.
He was once. Don't worry, he's perfectly respectable now. Probably hasn't killed anybody this week.
Lydia looked at him out of the corners of her eyes.
I'm joking.
Actually, there was no knowing if Vasquez had killed anybody lately or not. He'd obeyed cheerfully and with a will, if ordered to do so by his patron, Ranchmaster Don Eduardo. Shiny sunburst rowels as big as silver dollars sparkled at the ends of his spurs as Vasquez made his way to them, raising a hand in greeting.
Trouble always follows you, gringo. What misery do you bring now?
Nothing a man like you can't handle, large one.
True, but I like to know I'm shooting at.
Comanches. Mucho Comanches.
So you say. Señor Diego says maybe you got scared by a few Los Bravos Indios, that's all.
Sam looked around at the bustling courtyard. Brawny, heavy-set women in white blouses and colorful skirts filled ollas, water jugs, at the basin and carried them inside the hacienda. Gangly boys in baggy white shirts and pants and woven sandals bent double under the weight of massive bundles of firewood and stowed them away in the outbuildings. Riders came and went, stable hands, saddling and unsaddling horses.
They seem to be taking it seriously enough. And you?
I think maybe there's gonna be a fight.
Good thinking.
And the señorita, who is she?
The last of her family. Comanches hit their ranch in the hills today.
Ah, pobrecito, poor little one. A great misfortune for one so young.
Old enough to kill a jefe of Los Indios.
Vasquez gave the girl a second look, longer and more appraising.
So? Well, I expect no less from a friend of yours, young or old.
Hector, meet Lydia Fisher. Lydia, this is Señor Vasquez, ramrod of Rancho Grande.
Bending forward from the waist, Vasquez executed a courtly bow.
Welcome to our home, señorita. I'm sorry for your loss.
Thanks. Gracias, Señor Vasquez.
Lydia stuck her hand out for a handshake. It all but disappeared inside Vasquez's massive bear paw of a hand as he clasped hers lightly, shaking it. Going to Dusty, Sam took his flat wooden gun case down from the side of the saddle.
I'll take this and this.
He reached for a rolled-up dark garment tied in place like a bedroll behind the back of the saddle and tucked it under his arm.
Well, you see that our horses are taken care of. They've had a long, hot ride.
It shall be done.
Vasquez motioned to a couple of stable boys who came on the run. Lydia took her rifle from the saddle and held it under one arm.
You will not need that here, señorita.
I ain't letting go of it till the last Comanche is killed or quits.
As you will. A fit companion for you, gringo.
The stable boys led the horses away.
Will Brownie be okay? He's all I got now. Him and the rifle.
He'll be fine. I wouldn't leave Dusty if I thought differently.
Please, come with me to the hacienda, if you will.
Sam and Lydia stepped inside. The high front hall with tiled floors was cool. Closing the door, the servant led the two into the house. They went down a long hall with white-painted stuccoed walls showing dark brown wooden rafter beams and beam ends. The walls were hung with spiky, ornate crucifixes and somber portrait paintings in elaborate gilded frames. The portraits were so dark with age their subjects could barely be made out. An unlit iron chandelier hung on a chain from the ceiling.
It's like a palace.
In its way, it is.
The servant paused at the entrance of the great hall.
Señor Diego will see you now, señor. There are some refreshments prepared for the señorita. If she would be so good as to accompany me?
Lydia grabbed Sam's arm.
I want to stay with you.
It's all right. I won't be long.
Lydia, unhappy and suspicious, allowed him to persuade her to go with the servant woman. She led Lydia down a side passage toward the rear of the house.
Try not to shoot anybody.
A manservant appeared at the threshold of the hall's rounded archway, motioning for Sam to enter. Sam followed him into the grand hall, a spacious chamber 2 stories high. Stone pillars stood at regular intervals along whitewashed walls. Brightly colored woven tapestries and woolen blankets hung as decorations. The long west wall featured a row of tall, slender windows with peaked tops. In the grand hall, he found Diego Castillo and Lorena Castillo Delgado. Diego was the sole surviving scion of the Castillo bloodline. Age 30, tall, slim, and elegant, he looked every inch the grandee, imperious and arrogant. He wore custom-tailored clothes with expensive decorative lace at the throat and cuffs, and imported boots of hand-tooled Cordovan leather. His father, Don Eduardo Castillo, was the patron, the master of Rancho Grande. Thus, Diego must remain Señor Diego, able to assume the honorific Don Diego only upon the death of his father. Don Eduardo enjoyed excellent health, a fact Sam guessed gave little pleasure to his impatient, ambitious son. Lorena Castillo, born Lorena Delgado, was the childless widow of Don Eduardo's firstborn son. Originally from Mexico, she lived at the ranch. She was dark, with bold good looks and a sensational physique. Masses of black hair fell past her shoulders, framing a wide, sculpted bronze face with wide brown eyes and a full-lipped red slash of a mouth. She was garbed in a bolero jacket, starched white blouse, and tan riding breeches tucked into knee-high brown leather boots. She was smoking a small, thin black cigarillo and held a pumpkin glass of brandy. She was a willful, passionate woman. Sam wanted to trust her. He trusted few women and fewer men. Diego he trusted not at all. The manservant ushered in the newcomer, Diego dismissing him with a few words. Nodding acknowledgement of Sam's presence, Diego smiled thinly.
Ah, Señor Heller. Once again, you grace us with your company.
He spoke excellent English. His and Lorena's English was a lot better than Sam's smattering of Spanish.
The pleasure is all mine, senor.
A sublime thrill, Lorena, no?
No.
You must forgive my father, Don Eduardo, for not being here to greet you in person. A slight indisposition has confined him to his bedchamber, alas.
Nothing serious, I hope.
Not at all, thank you. I am sure he will make a full recovery presently.
Presently? Remembering Don Eduardo's hatred for Anglos, Sam was sure that his full recovery would miraculously occur immediately after Sam had left. On the assumption that all Anglos were eager to rob him of his vast holdings, Don Eduardo was far from mistaken. His ownership, well documented by deeds, titles, and Spanish land grants, was upheld by a small army of well-armed, hard-riding pistoleros. It was a signal mark of favor that an Anglo such as Sam Heller was even allowed under the Castillo roof. Sam rendered the family several important services in the past, and might again in the future, so the patriarch allowed him into the hacienda, while shunning direct contact with him, letting such encounters be carried out by his son and daughter-in-law.
Señora Castillo, I regret we're not meeting under happier circumstances.
Always a happiness to host a friend of Rancho Grande. We saw your arrival through the window. The young one who was with you, who is she?
A friend, Lydia Fisher, a brave girl.
Sam briefly outlined the circumstances that had thrown them together on the plateau and afterward. Diego smiled politely throughout his narrative. Lorena alternated puffs on her slim dark cigarillo with sips of brandy.
A most remarkable account.
Yes, remarkable indeed.
And every word of it is true.
Oh, I don't doubt that you crossed paths with some Comanche bravos. Since the end of the Great War between your north and south, the savages have become emboldened, once more venturing on their old raiding trails. We have heard of packs of them striking out on the llano. Some band or two may even be in the county. But surely not in the numbers you claim.
Looks like the Rancho's getting ready to fight. And a good thing, too.
That is none of my doing, I assure you. My father, Don Eduardo, has a long memory. The days of his adventurous youth, when the Comanche often tried their strength against the Ranchero, is still fresh in his mind. He takes the path of greater caution. It was his order that the ranch be made ready in case of attack.
Diego made a show of smiling tolerantly, as if amused and indulgent of the oldster's foibles.
In all honesty, I confess I do not share his alarm, and in his place, I would have done differently.
I thought you might feel that way. Seeing is believing.
Sam set the gun case flat on a drum-shaped side table to free his hands and unrolled the dark garment he'd brought with him, holding an end in both hands and letting it fall free in front of him. It smelled of sweat, smoke, and blood.
Take a look.
Diego's finely formed nostrils quivered in delicate disgust, expressing repugnance. Fascinated, Lorena moved closer for a better look.
What is it?
It belonged to the Comanche known as Black Robe. I took it off his dead body not long ago. He took it off a priest he killed. The story of how he got it is well known throughout the West. I reckon word of it might even have reached inside Rancho Grande.
Diego stared at it despite himself. Lorena eyed it with awe and unease.
If you don't believe me, ask Vasquez or any of the vaqueros. I'm sure they know the story. They'll tell you that Black Robe is the lieutenant of Red Hand, Mano Rojo, the fiercest Comanche war chief in the territory. I'm sure you've heard of him.
Wide-eyed, lips parted, Lorena nodded in agreement. Diego had a worried look, a little twitch fired off in the corner of his mouth.
I suppose it is better for us to be prepared. Though I find it hard to credit that even Mano Rojo would be so foolish as to try his strength against ours. Ah, let them come. They will break against the stone of our walls and the fire of our guns.
I'm sure. And now that I've said my piece, I'll be on my way.
You're leaving? Where will you go?
I've done my bit here. I'm going to town. Hangtree's got to be warned that Red Hand and his Comanches are coming.
Better to stay, safe, behind the walls of the Ranchero.
Gracias, but if I don't spread the word, who will?
You are loco, gringo.
Maybe. I've kept one step ahead of the Braves all day. With any luck, I'll stay that way. I'd like to ask a favor, though.
With the service you have rendered us, we are hardly in a position to refuse.
My horse Dusty is plumb worn out. I'd like to borrow a pair of horses, fast ones.
Why two?
If I get chased, a fresh horse might give me that extra burst of speed to get clear.
It shall be done as you wish.
The girl, Lydia, I can't take her with me. I'd be much obliged if you'd let her stay here until the danger is over.
Oh, claro, Señor Heller. Of course, I will look after her until you return.
I can't ask more than that. Thanks. I've got to warn you, though. She's a handful.
Lorena's thin smile showed her confidence in managing the girl.
I must confer with the Segundo to make sure our defenses are in order. Lorena will see to the horses and anything else you might need, Señor Heller. Your service to Rancho Grande is most appreciated and will not be forgotten. Now, if you will excuse me, I will take my leave.
Many thanks, Señor.
Diego hurried across the room, into the corridor, and out of sight.
I'll keep this to convince any other doubting Thomases.
Sam rolled up Black Robe's cape. He picked up his gun case off the drum table, holding it by the suitcase-style handle.
I ain't had much to eat today. It would be a kindness if the cook could fix me up a cut of beef between two slices of bread.
I think we can do better than that.
That's all I want. I want to travel light, not be weighed down.
Come with me.
I gotta tell the girl I'm going. From what I've seen of her, she won't much care for staying behind.
She would like losing that yellow hair of hers to a Comanche scalp hunter even less. I'll go tell one of the boys to get the horses ready.
She turned and left. Lydia sat at a wooden table in a side room of the kitchen, picking idly at her plate. It was loaded with food, but she hadn't taken more than a few bites. A big glass of milk seemed equally untouched. Sam didn't blame her. He hated milk. Lydia's rifle stood propped upright in the corner. She looked troubled by Sam's leave-taking.
I don't want to stay here. Let me go with you.
You've risked your neck enough for one day.
I don't want to be alone with strangers.
Lorena, Senora Castillo will look after you.
She's a stranger! Anyhow, I don't need looking after.
I believe it. In that case, you look after her.
Man.
Now don't go getting any ideas.
You like her, don't you?
She's a friendly acquaintance, that's all.
Is that what you call it?
I like lots of folks. I like you?
Sure, but not in the same way.
The conversation was interrupted by the arrival of the cook, a stout, moon-faced woman. She handed Sam a brown paper bag with a couple of sandwiches inside.
Gracias.
She went back to her chores.
Gotta be moving on, Lydia. I'll be back for you when the Comanche is whooped.
Lydia sat with elbows on the table, tight little fists pressed against the side of her head, pouting.
Well, ain't you gonna say goodbye? No? Well, that's all right. We sure had ourselves some ride, coming off the plateau and across the flat. You done real good. Your folks would be proud of you. I'm proud of you. Proud to know you. See you soon.
He started toward the corridor.
Mr. Yank!
He turned, looking back.
Take care of yourself.
I'll do that. And Lydia, don't be too hard on the Senora. For a great grand lady, she's not so bad.
Sam followed Lorena outside to find a vaquero waiting patiently nearby, sitting his horse. A lead rope hitched around his saddle horn trailed behind him to a string of three horses, all saddled and ready to go. Sam knew him. Latigo, a pistolero with plenty of sand.
Latigo will go with you.
Thanks, but I don't need him. He travels fastest who travels alone.
Still, I will feel better if there is another along to watch your back. One gun, more or less, won't make any difference to the fortune of the Grande, but it could make a very great difference to you. Latigo is one of mine. Loyal first to the Delgados, not the Castillos.
I've seen him at work. Good man.
But bad enough to stay alive. Like you, amigo.
And you?
Sam crossed to Latigo. The pistolero, in his mid-20s, was of medium height with a runner's build. Beneath the sombrero, thick black hair was parted in the middle, the ends reaching down to his jawline. He sported a blue bandana headband. He had almond-shaped eyes and a thin mustache. He lifted a hand in greeting, holding it palm up for a beat before letting it fall to his side.
We meet again.
Sure you want to go along?
Ah. Why not? It's a nice day for a ride.
In that case, I'll stay here and you go.
I don't like riding that much, gringo.
Letigo's gaze dropped to the sawed-off Winchester and its special long holster hanging down Sam's right thigh.
I see you still have the trick gun, the kick of the burro.
Mule's leg, partner.
That's what I said.
In Hangtown, a distant clamor in the west nagged at the attention of the militiamen and ramrod riders facing off at opposite ends of Trail Street. A crackle of noise like exploding firecrackers was immediately followed by the strident ringing of the church bell as it was struck by a series of shots. Quentin Stafford pulled his gun, pointing it at Sheriff Mac Barton, standing at the other end of the street with his back to the courthouse.
It's a double cross! I'll learn them, the dirty bastards!
Clay threw out a hand.
Don't!
Oxblood sidled his horse into Quentin, spoiling the latter's aim. The shot went wild, thudding into the side of a building. Barton wasn't the sort to mull things over. He turned, slapping leather, leveling his gun on the Stafford crowd.
No account backshooters?
Before the situation could explode into all-out gunfire between the two sides, a stagecoach made its entrance, barreling east on Trail Street. An irresistible force with its six-horse team on the gallop, trailing four horses on a lead rope. For the militiamen grouped in the street between the Cattleman Hotel and the Alamo Bar, it was run or be trampled. Rather than go under hooves and wheels, they scrambled for the sidelines. The sudden scattering kept the tense standoff from exploding into a battle royale. Quentin turned to Oxblood.
What'd you do that for? You made me miss.
Clay thrust a pointing finger west.
Indians!
A bunch of Comanches who'd been in the lead, close behind the stagecoach, rushed through the gap between the church and Boot Hill and into town. Confronted by armed townfolk gawking on the sides of the street, they opened up on them with bullets and arrows. The initial rush caught many citizens flat-footed. The slow and the luckless were first to die. Among the ramrod crowd, horses milled, their riders confused and unsure. Guns were drawn.
What do we do, boss?
Get clear and shoot!
Shoot who?
Get you, you blam idiot!
Vince was good as his word, pointing his sixth gun at an oncoming brave and banging away at him. More Comanches came tearing over the West Ridge, some charging down the trail, others peeling off to the sides to ride through Boot Hill around the church.
Son of a...
Barton was holding fire on the Staffords. Comanches were pouring into town. Running half-crouched to the corner of the Cattleman Hotel, he got around it and turned his gun on the Braves. The stagecoach tore wildly down the street. Luckily, no one was run over or seriously injured. Deputy Small stepped out holding a shotgun in front of a charging, lance-wielding Comanche rider. The Blast sprayed the spearman into the street. Stung by a buckshot, the pony screamed and raced away. Clay Stafford tried to rally his men.
Move aside, boys! Take cover!
The Ramrod riders spurred their horses mostly to the north side of the street, getting behind the courthouse front. The Stafford crowd held more than its share of quick-triggered gunmen. They already had guns in hand. Comanches raced into town, straight into a barrage launched by Ramrod riders. Crashing rounds of gunfire burst forth. The Braves fired back, but they were outnumbered 2-1 by the Gunhawks. Only half the Braves survived that initial onslaught. Their charge took them beyond the town limits, into the open. Latigo, working the reins of the stagecoach, moved it onto the street between the courthouse and the Golden Spur, providing a safe haven from the battle that continued to rage through the town. The vehicle jostled to a halt. Recovering from the shock of the surprise attack, the townfolk had begun to regroup and return fire. The number of militiamen already grouped en masse in the street quickly mounted an effective counterstrike against the raiders. Also well-armed and geared for trouble were those of the Ramrod, who fought back hard and fast. In the grid of streets and cross streets comprising the heart of town, more Braves spilled into the dirt, their ponies bolting free. The tide was turning. Quick to adapt, the Comanches retreated from the costly fusillade on Trail Street. Their fight was not yet done, however. Breaking up into small groups of twos and threes, they spread out through the rest of town in search of less well-protected citizens. A woman in a boarding house on a cross street north of the Alamo Bar went to the window to investigate the source of the racket. Standing at an open second-floor window, she was shot by a Comanche rifleman. She fell to the floor, sinking out of sight below the windowsill, and died. Gunfire continued to pop elsewhere as the main clash on Trail Street subsided. Wounded Comanches stayed grimly silent, due not only to their stoic nature, but also the certainty that they would live longer by not calling attention to themselves in the midst of their enemies. A hardcore group of militiamen formed around Sheriff Barton and Boone Lassiter, Hutto's top gun. Among them were Hutto himself, Russ Lockhart, Deputy Smalls, and a steadily growing number of others. Lockhart was lining up another shot.
The Red Devils? Well, I haven't so much as shown their faces in the hang tree since before the war!
Barton reloaded his six gun.
Well, they're here now.
Looks like we got them on the run.
Keep your gun ready and your eyes open. You can't count on nothing where Comanches are concerned. Be like them to fake breaking off the attack only to regroup and hit us again one more time.
Hutto looked down the street.
It could have been worse. If we hadn't gathered to buck the Ramrod, they would have fallen on this town like wolves on a sheepfold.
Wonder how Stafford's bunch made out.
Well, Vince caught a bullet and it'd solve a lot of problems.
Hutto's man, Lassiter, grinned.
Hey, you won't be rid of Vince so easily. He's too blamed ornery to be that obliging.
We don't want to lose Vince just yet. We'll need every man jack we've got if the Comanches return.
They wouldn't dare.
Why not?
Nobody had an answer to that one. Deputy Smalls looked distinctly unwell, pale, pasty-faced, and beaded with cold sweat.
Hell, they ain't quit yet.
You're showing a little green around the gills, Deputy.
I got excited and swallowed my chaw tobacco by mistake. Oh, I'm feeling mighty low down in the belly.
Barton peered east on Trail Street.
Vince made it. He's still with us.
Someone will have to speak to him to arrange a truce until the Comanche threat is done.
Someone, huh? Who could that be? As if I didn't know.
You're doing a fine job, Mac. You're the only one can handle Stafford. He respects you.
Respects me enough to put a bullet in my back.
That wasn't Vince. Looked like Quint shot at you.
Oh, he did he?
Let's get squared away first.
I'll square Quint away.
We'll have to comb the town street by street to make sure the Comanches are all gone.
Lassiter shook his head.
Street by street? Hell, house by house. It'd be just like those devils for a few of them to find a hiding place to set for a few hours, let things calm down before cutting up again.
On the side street, Sam finished reloading his Winchester and climbed down from his perch. Latigo reached into the box under the seat, hauling out the carbine, which had remained unfired since he first took the reins of the stagecoach. Sam put his face in a window of the coach.
How you folks doing in there?
Sally and I are all right, but Junie started bleeding again. Bad.
Mary Anderson's dark eyes stared out of a strained white face. The front of June's dress was soaked with dark, fresh blood from the arrow she took in the initial attack on the stage out on the trail.
We've got to get her to a doctor.
We will, Ms. Anderson.
A Comanche rode west on Trail Street, flashing past the gap between the courthouse and the Golden Spur. Latigo fired and the brave spilled into the street, lying motionless. The horse kept going, running out of sight. Sam eyed the broken lead line tied to the rear of the stagecoach.
Looks like Don Eduardo is out four horses.
Well, he would love you all the more.
Blame the Comanches, not me.
He has love enough in his heart for both. Though he will be quick to point out, you did not have to help the stagecoach fight off the raiding party.
A door in the east wall of the Golden Spur creaked open. Sam and Latigo spun, pointing their rifles at it.
Don't shoot, it's only me.
Standing in the doorway, Johnny Cross raised his hands and smiled. Sam and Latigo lowered their weapons.
Trust a Yank to be in the middle of all that shooting and whatnot. The bad penny always turns up somehow.
Sam looked him over.
I was thinking the same about you.
The girl, June, was dead. Sometime during the chase into town, the rough ride caused the arrowhead to cut something vital, and she'd bled to death. A stricken Mary Anderson and her sobbing 12-year-old niece were taken in tow by some of the women of the church committee and escorted to a place of safety. At least, as safe as any in Hangtown. But how safe could that be, Sam wondered, with Red Hand's Comanches on the warpath within striking distance? He hoped he wouldn't find out, but he knew better. The rest of the passengers made their way to the Cattleman Hotel. Sam and Latigo sat at the front of the stagecoach.
Could be a reward from the stagecoach line for bringing in their property. If there is, we'll split it. If not, we'll sell the coach and horses and split the cash.
That sounded good to Latigo, who moved the team out and to Hobson's livery stable south of the jail. Hobson had survived the raid intact and unharmed, as had his son and principal helper, a red-haired, freckle-faced kid. Hobson, a brawny titan who doubled as town blacksmith, wore a pair of holstered six guns. He made arrangements to board the stagecoach team and the string of six horses. He asked no prying questions as Sam paid in hard cash, including something extra for the trouble of securing the coach. He told Hobson what he'd seen on the plateau, burned-out ranches, slaughtered settlers, and the temporary camp of several hundred Comanches in Lago Gulch, the raiding party that killed the driver and guard on the stage, leaving the team to run wild until Sam and Latigo cut down the Comanches and saved the rig. Hobson took the bad news with about as much excitement as if they were talking about the weather. He didn't crack too much.
Let's find the sheriff.
The sheriff wasn't hard to find. He was standing on the porch of the Cattleman Hotel, surrounded by a cluster of the town's leading citizens, at least in their own estimation. A larger group of town folk, mostly men, but some women and children, were grouped in the street around the front of the hotel, facing Barton and the notables. Now that the Comanches had been driven off, more people were emerging from behind bolted doors and shuttered windows to venture outside. Sam grinned wryly to himself. He was the bearer of ill tidings that, when they learned of it, would send most of them back running for cover. Wanting to keep a low profile, Sam decided against bullying through the crowd and bracing the sheriff in public. Motioning to Latigo, he led him around behind the building to the back of the hotel. They walked through the kitchen and pushed open double-swinging doors that accessed the main dining room, a large space filled with tables and chairs, but no diners. A half-dozen white-aproned members of the kitchen staff, cooks, assistants, and waiters, stood gathered under an archway facing the front entrance. On the other side of the hallway, standing near the front entrance, where he could observe Barton and company organizing the townfolk, was Lloyd Garvey, the desk clerk, a prematurely aged young man with permanently hunched, rounded shoulders. It took something on the order of an Indian attack to flush Garvey out from behind the front desk, where he customarily held court, dispensing room keys and keeping the rest of the staff on their toes.
Why, Mr. Heller, what are you doing here?
Sam didn't munch cotton to his own cooking and ate dinner at the Cattleman several nights a week. The desk clerk was in a position to know plenty about the hotel's occupants and visitors, their comings and goings, and Sam's peculiar trade thrived on such bits of timely intelligence. He kept Garvey plied with gratuities to keep him nice and pliable. Sam opened his hand, a gold coin nestling in his palm. He held it so only Garvey could see it, and that briefly, because Garvey made it disappear with a smooth, well-oiled skill that comes of much practice.
How may I be of service?
I want a word with the sheriff.
Oh, I can't interrupt him. I'm only the desk clerk.
And tell Barton that if he wants to have a town to be sheriff of, he'd better listen to what I've got to say.
Garvey goggled, his eyes bulging, his Adam's apple bobbing.
Well, give it to him just like I said. If he gets sore, he'll be mad at me, not you. So you'll be in the clear. Make sure you tell him so only he can hear it. We don't want to go starting a panic.
Well, okay.
Approaching Barton from the side, Garvey tugged at his sleeve. Startled at being interrupted by such a lackey, the sheriff could only assume the desk clerk had something worth hearing.
Excuse me, folks.
Barton leaned toward Garvey, turning an ear to him. Speaking behind his hand, Garvey passed along Sam's words. Barton looked over his shoulder into the hotel. Sam gave him the high sign, motioning for Barton to come to him. The sheriff was a quick study. He blanked his expression, assuming a poker face before turning to face the buzzing crowd once more.
Take over for a minute, Wade.
Huh? What? Wait a minute!
Barton entered the hotel, closing on Sam. Outside, Hutto had hold of Garvey's lapel and was no doubt inquiring into the latest odd turn of events.
All right, folks, now calm down. Everything will be under control shortly.
A quick study himself, Hutto recovered and commenced speechifying to the citizens, plying them with soothing generalities.
You!
Barton stood face to face with Sam.
You brought the Comanches into town.
Not hardly.
Barton pointed a finger at Latigo.
And you too, huh? You're a long way from Rancho Grande.
I wish I was there.
That makes two of us. I wish you was there, too.
We brought the stagecoach in. The Comanches wanted it, but we wouldn't give it to them.
You got some tall talking to do, mister.
He knew Sam Heller was a bounty hunter, a Yankee gunman who had drifted into town in the aftermath of the war between the states, and then just set, not moving on. A most mysterious fellow, he had somehow engineered the destruction of the Harbin gang, which was no mean feat. The stranger had some pull with the blue-belly commander of Fort Pardee, too, but that was no surprise. Those damned Yankees all stuck together. Barton had as little use for Sam as he had for any northerner, none. Yet he knew to let sleeping dogs lie. The sheriff was in no hurry to brace him or run him out of town. Even a Yankee bounty killer had his uses in the time and place where so many violent men flourished. An excited Hutto made his way into the hotel, rushing up to Barton.
What's going on?
Well, let's step off to the side, in private.
What?
This has got to be handled carefully.
Sam turned, crossing to an alcove in the lobby, the others trailing after him.
This'll do.
With the dead strewn about the streets and the cries of the wounded still ringing in their ears, Hutto and Barton needed little in the way of convincing when Sam told them that Red Hand and his Comanche warriors were gathered to hit Hangtown in force, and soon. Black Robe's famed garment, well known by ill repute in that part of the West, removed any lingering doubts.
Red Hand's a bad one. Watonka knows when to pull in his horns, but Red Hand's looking to make a name for himself.
What do we do?
Fight him.
Oh, brilliant. Got any more bright ideas, Heller?
Yep. Get Stafford and Damon to call a ceasefire.
Johnny Cross had told him about the standoff.
We could use the firepower. Those ramrod guns already came in mighty handy.
It can't hurt to ask.
Then gather all the women and children, and anyone else who needs protection, and get them all into the courthouse to stay until this is over.
The Mexes, too?
Of course.
You can't mix white folks and Mexes in the same place.
Hutto was suddenly aware of Latigo's cool-eyed glance falling on him.
Oh, that is, the Mexican element want to stick to their own kind, just as we do.
You speak true, senor. We no more want to be with you than you want to be with us.
We need as much firepower in one place as we can get. Vince Stafford and Damon Bolt have postponed killing each other and agreed to a truce. The folk of Hangtown, Anglo and Mex, will have to forgo the pleasure of their prejudices till the Comanche is whooped. And believe me, that's a long way off from being a sure thing.
Lockhart shook a small bony fist under Sam's nose.
You low-down Yankee leveler, you?
Your differences will seem mighty small once those braves start coming at you, and keep coming.
Is that all?
No, but it's a start.
Hangtown made ready for war, teeming with activity like a disturbed anthill. In addition to the two watchmen posted in the church bell tower, two more were stationed in the courthouse clock tower at the other side of town. That ensured against a Comanche sneak from east as well as west. Two watchers in each observation post was protection against a lone sentry falling asleep. A very real threat in a town where whiskey flowed freely with no lack of passionate devotees. Hutto found two volunteers willing to risk riding out to Anvil Flats in the breaks to fetch the U.S. cavalry troop escorting Major Adams' wagon train. The two, Hapgood and Coleman, were each willing to make the attempt for $100 in gold, more money than either had ever seen in one place at one time. The courthouse, the strongest and most secure structure in Hangtown, served as headquarters. Families from all parts of town streamed to it, women and children massing in the large, high-ceilinged courtroom. Hangtown was too large to be defended as a whole. The heart of the defense was four corners, where the courthouse, the jail, the feed store, and the Golden Spur all met. Town folk were leery of leaving treasured possessions unguarded in abandoned homes and shops, but were allowed to bring only water, food, weapons, and similar necessities into the courthouse. The gathering included the folk of Mextown. Clangor boomed as long, high-backed courtroom benches were taken apart to serve as barricades. Glass was knocked out of windows, a preemptive measure to protect against injuries from razor-sharp glass shards during a battle. Backs, seats, and struts from the disassembled benches were nailed in place as bulwarks at the bottom halves of the painless windows. The aftermath of the war between the states was a time of scarcity throughout Texas and the rest of the South, but Hangtown had guns and ammunition aplenty. A sizable arsenal was amassed, apart from the rifles, shotguns, and pistols with which the locals already went about armed. Foodstuffs and supplies of fresh drinking water were stockpiled against the long siege. They were kept in a storeroom under lock and key, under the watchful eyes of guards posted by Barton. Buckets of water were distributed throughout the building as prevention against fire. Buckets of sand were also in place to soak up slippery blood that might coat the floor. The flat roofs of the jail, feed store, and carpenter shop would serve as platforms for riflemen, as would the loft of the stable bar. Quantities of hay, oats, and water for horses were massed inside the enclosure, serving a double purpose of reinforcing makeshift walls. Scores of horses were gathered for the penning. The big corral, as it was called, thronged with horses. A wealth of prime horse flesh, an irresistible target for Red Hand and his warrior braves. A reserve stock was set aside to serve as a mounted force against the Comanches and to carry out errands and make the rounds of the town. The Staffords and the Ramrod Bunch set up in the feed store. Store owner Dickerson grudgingly consented to house the Ramrod Riders in the building. Vince Stafford had come out in favor of it, and Dickerson didn't want to go against him. Few did. A big building, the feed store stood alone, sharing its lot with no adjacent structures, and almost directly opposite the Golden Spur and Damon Bolt, the special object, though not the only one, of Vince Stafford's ire. It was the prime reason Vince proposed the arrangement. He could keep the gambling house under observation while waiting out the Comanche onslaught. The sun had set, purple dusk deepening into night. Barton stood outside the barricade smoking a cigar. He looked around. It was risky, putting the Ramrod Bunch so close to the Golden Spur, but it kept both parties well away from the women and children forted up in the courthouse. Closer to home, he eyed the Dog Star troops, shaking his head in mock disbelief.
What a crew. Looks like a posse should be chasing you, fellas.
Squint McCray grinned.
Funny, huh? Us boys making our stand here at the jail, that is.
Why not? For most of you, it's your home away from home. I ought to charge rent for all the time you ranigans have slept off a drunk back in the cell.
Rent? What do you think them fines were?
Where else are you and your crowd gonna light? Not in the courthouse with the respectable folk. They won't have you. Not in the Spur. Damon wouldn't chance all you booze hounds getting so close to his fine, high-priced liquor.
Hard words, Sheriff. Hard words.
But true. And you sure don't want to bed down with Vince and his friends.
Shoot, I wouldn't piss on him if he was on fire.
Maybe Red Hand will do just that and set him on fire for you not to piss on him.
I can hope. Anyhow, the jailhouse is the place to be. Good, solid walls.
You ought to know. You've been behind them enough.
Dark was the night, and long, as Latigo and Sam worked on a special project.
Do you know the truce of God, amigo?
No, can't say as I do.
At midnight on the cloudy night, the moon played peekaboo with the clouds. Bright silver moonlight alternated with ghostly silver-black gloom. A farmer's old saw Sam often heard during boyhood days in southwest Minnesota maintained that for the best crop yields, some planting was done by moonlight. He and Latigo were doing some planting of their own on the far west edge of Hangtown, sowing seeds of destruction to reap a crop of pure hell. It was an idea he'd had to lay out a special welcome mat for Red Hand. Surprise package, so to speak. Sam and Latigo were laying the groundwork to make it happen. They were not the only agents of the plan. Others were at work in other parts of Hangtown, carrying out similar preparations. Moonlight or shadow, which is best, Sam wondered. Moonlight meant he could see better, but he could also be seen. Shadow hid him, but also hid others who were lurking. Comanches, it was said, didn't attack at night. Not true. They preferred not to attack at night, but they weren't ones to pass up an opportunity, no matter what the hour, day or night. Sam and Latigo labored on the flat below the church and Boot Hill. With them were two horses and a mule laden down with sacks full of hardware, bundled sticks of dynamite, wooden stakes, digging implements, and strips of cloth.
We've got our necks stuck out a country mile.
Two men in the church tower kept watch for Comanches, but Sam preferred to trust his own perceptions. Not that he trusted them so well. A breeze was blowing from the west, making the night air cool and fresh. Latigo held the horse's reins and the mule's lead rope. Sam was down on one knee beside a shallow hole in the ground. A wooden stake had been hammered partway into the hard-packed clay. A narrow band of cloth 12 inches long was knotted around the top of the stake. In the moonlight, the cloth looked gray. Its true color was red. Sam placed a bundle of dynamite in the hole, laying it on its side lengthwise. Rising, he took up a spade, sticking the blade into a pile of dirt that had been excavated from the hole. Carefully, very carefully, for all the sticks of dynamite were fitted with blasting caps, he sprinkled the dirt over the bundled explosives. The dirt mound disappeared quickly as he refilled the shallow hole. Using a leafy branch he'd broken off a bush, he evened off the dirt on top of the hole to disguise the marks of digging. Only the stake with the strip of cloth tied to it marked the spot where the dynamite had been buried. Five more such banded stakes were studded at regular intervals across the broad apron of ground fronting the rise to the church. Sam put the spade and the leafy branch in one of the burlap sacks slung across the mule's back. He rubbed his palms together, wiping the dust from them.
It'll do it for here.
Do you know the truce of God, amigo?
No. What is it?
In Mexico, in the swamps around Veracruz on the coast, they say that when there is a great flood, all the animals in the jungle flee to higher ground. Trapped all together, the creatures do not follow their natural way. El tigre, the jaguar, falls not on the sheep to kill and eat it. The snake preys not on the rabbit, nor the fox on the chicken. All are at peace with each other until the waters go down. This is the truce of God.
Tell me, Latigo, have you ever seen this truce of God?
In flood, no. For I have lived most of my life here on the plains of Tejas, where the floods are not so much. But with mine own eyes, I have seen something like it during prairie fires. When animals flee the fire, none attacks the other.
Because they all fear being eaten by the flames.
So it is with the folk of Hangtown, no? Fear of the Comanche is stronger than their hate for each other.
It's a truce, maybe, but not of God. The Lord and Hangtown are pretty far apart.
Quien sabe, amigo? Who knows?
Well, that's the way to bet it.
Sam brushed over the filled-in holes with a leafy branch, smoothing out the dirt. The two men mounted their horses.
A good trick, that dynamite. If the Comanche come this way...
If they don't, the other approaches to Four Corners are planted, too. We'll get them coming or going.
Is it that you like Hangtown so well, or hate the Comanche so much?
I like living. If we beat Red Hand here, we live. If not...
Red Hand was wary of mysterious activities his scouts had observed going on around town in the hour before midnight. The Texans were up to something. Groups of two prowled around the edges of Four Corners for reasons unknown. His men were unable to get close enough to determine exactly what it was they were doing. He would give the Texans something to think about during the long hours of the night watch. He sent in a band of skirmishers to start trouble on the west side of town. The moon came out from behind a cloud, shafting silver rays. Sam and Latigo continued on Trail Street.
What now?
We get something to eat and drink, maybe catch a few hours of shut-eye, and wait for sunup.
They neared the Alamo Bar. Strange to see the Alamo dark, shuttered and locked up, Sam thought. Ordinarily, it would just be hitting its stride, riotous and ablaze with light. But it was black and silent as a tomb, as was the rest of Hangtown outside Four Corners, itself dimly lit with few figures showing. Something burst out of the north side street, streaking overhead. Great wings beat the air as an owl soared up and out of sight. Startled, Sam's horse upreared, forelegs leaving the ground. He clung to the animal to keep from being thrown. Unseen objects whipped past him in the dark. Arrows. Latigo was hit. Sam threw himself off the horse on the opposite side from the source of the Comanche arrows. The mule brayed, breaking free and running down Trail Street. Latigo was still in the saddle, hunched forward with an arrow sticking out of his chest. He grabbed his gun and fired at the ambushers. At least one shot scored. Another arrow took Latigo in the torso. He tilted sideways, firing a shot into the air as he fell off his horse. A Comanche darted out of the street, tomahawk in hand. He charged Sam, who lay sprawling on his back in the street. Sam drew the Navy Colt stuck in his belt. On his feet, Sam advanced, levering the mule's leg, cutting down Comanches all the way to Commerce Street. He watched as the two Comanches who had stayed behind to hold the horses hopped on the backs of their ponies to make their escape. Screened by a row of buildings, they were safe from Sam's bullets. The deadly little skirmish was over, but Latigo was dead. Throughout Four Corners, attention focused on the dark west side of town from where the shooting seemed to have come. Red Hand and 12 followers hid in a dark grove of trees 100 yards east of town. Part of a well-wooded thicket north of Hangtree Trail, it was a tangle of brush, shrubs, and tall weeds. When the shooting started on the west side of town, Red Hand rode out alone into the open toward the courthouse. Outfitted in full warlike regalia, he rode a strikingly colored silver horse with a white mane. A bonnet of eagle feathers crowned his head. His face was striped and masked with war paint. His torso was shielded by a chest piece made of buffalo bones, and his arms were painted red from fingertips to elbows. A round buffalo hide shield was worn on his left arm. His right hand held a flaming spear. Not the fire lance, of course. It was too valuable to be thrown away on a mere ploy. And that's what he was engaged in. A bold stroke to steal the Texans' courage and plant fear in their hearts. Red Hand wielded a Comanche lance whose spear blade was coated with Medicine Hat's inflammable compound and set ablaze. He crossed the field, charging the courthouse front. Close to the courthouse steps, he yanked hard on the reins. The silver stallion reared, rising on its hind legs. Red Hand cast the fiery lance, burying it point first in one of the wooden front double doors. It stuck, quivering in a planked panel, its head burning with eerie blue ghost light. Turning his horse to the right, he galloped away into the darkness. His men in the grove opened fire on the courthouse with repeating rifles, laying out a covering of fire for their chief. Once Red Hand was safely clear, they ceased fire, melting back into the woods. Drawn by this new disturbance, the courthouse folk rushed to the east windows to see what it was all about. Wade Hutto looked outside and saw the burning spear stuck in the courthouse front door. Banker Willoughby turned his puzzled gaze on Hutto.
What's it all about?
A declaration of war, I call it.
As if any were needed. They've already made their hostile intent clear.
Boone Lassiter shook his head.
Comanche medicine to scare the faint-hearts. Hope nobody falls for it. But they will.
The fiery spear kept on burning. Presently, some hardy souls opened the front door part way, mindful not to show themselves as targets, threw buckets of sand on it, and beat it with blankets until the flames went out. A few door planks were charred, but only on the surface, not too deep. The door was slammed shut and bolted from the inside. An hour or so later, it started. It came from somewhere in the grove from which Red Hand had previously ventured. Thick woods and darkness hid whatever was going on there. It was the sound of a man in mortal agony. Worse, it was only the opening note in what would prove to be an aria of anguish. It was loud and clear throughout Four Corners. A small lamp burned in Hutto's office, glowing dimly.
God! What are they doing to that poor devil?
Torture?
Willoughby went to the east window, looking out.
I don't see nobody. No engines. Nothing.
You won't see them until they want you to see them.
Who is it, do you think?
Some poor soul unlucky enough to be taken alive. Lord help him.
Think it's Coleman or Hapgood?
Let's hope not. They're our only hope of getting word to the cavalry.
Don't count on the army. We're on our own here.
Hutto's face fell.
There's a good chance that one or both of them might have gotten through. Isn't there?
Thank God that's over.
Boone Lassiter rolled his eyes.
Hell, they ain't even started yet.
He poured himself a fresh drink.
What did they do to make a man scream like that?
Don't think about it.
Lassiter gulped his drink, setting down an empty glass.
Save a bullet for yourself if we can't hold them today. Save some for your families, too.
Why don't you just shut up and die? Die, damn you! Die!
Easy.
Comanches know what they're doing. They'll keep him alive for a long time. They're good at that. By working on him, they're working on us, trying to put the fear in us.
They're doing a pretty good job.
Wade Hutto rose from his chair.
Better go downstairs and make a show to the folks, take their mind off things, reassure them. They might need some shoring up.
I can use some shoring up myself.
Willoughby poured a stiff drink. In Francine's room of the Golden Spur, Johnny Cross slipped out of bed, his eyes accustomed to the dimness. He'd been lying awake in bed for some time. He dressed quietly, then sat on the bed while he donned socks and boots. Yellow light from the hallway outlined the closed door. Moonbeams shafted through lacy-curtained windows, spilling onto the bed. Sheets and blankets were tangled up around Francine. She lay on her side, legs bent at the knees, one long, bare leg showing outside the bed coverings. White blonde hair spilled across the pillows, partly covering her face. Her body was all shining silver and black shadow.
She's beautiful.
Running off so soon?
Sky's lightening in the east. Things are gonna start happening. I best be up and doing.
Johnny was restless, couldn't sleep. His twin holstered guns hung over the top of the brass bedpost. He draped his gun belt over an arm. Francine moved around in bed, reaching for him. He bent down to kiss her. Her mouth was warm. After a while, he eased clear of her embrace. Taking his hat from the top of the bureau where he'd left it, he put it on his head and walked to the door. He turned back to Francine.
I'll see you.
Be careful, Johnny. Stay alive. I'll be waiting for you.
Johnny filled his eyes with her once more, then stepped into the hall. It was quiet when he reached the main floor. Most of those gathered there, Anglos and Mexican-Americans, were asleep. Johnny smiled. He smelled fresh-brewed coffee. Morrissey stood behind the bar, sleepy eyes heavy-lidded, resting his weight on meaty forearms pressed against the counter. Sam Heller stood by himself at one end of the bar, eating a roast beef sandwich and drinking a cup of coffee. Johnny went to them.
Coffee smells good. Can you do me a cup?
Coming right up.
Morrissey pushed himself off the counter.
A shot of whiskey would go nice in that.
You got it.
Morrissey splashed whiskey in a cup, filling the rest of it with a hot black brew from the coffee pot. He set it down on the bar in front of Johnny.
Thanks.
Swirls of steam rose from the surface of the liquid in the cup. Johnny held it under his nose. It smelled good, the rich, pungent coffee aroma mingling with raw whiskey fumes. It tasted even better. He picked up the cup and took it down the bar to stand beside Sam Heller.
Let it go?
Dead.
Sorry.
Me too. He died game.
Can't ask for more than that.
I reckon not.
Sam finished up his sandwich and drained his cup.
What's next?
I'll be heading for the church directly. Want to get there and be in place well before sunup.
I'll tag along if you don't mind.
Sam's eyebrows lifted.
In a hurry to get yourself killed?
I'm not one for sitting around. I like to take the fight to the enemy. Besides, a Yankee son of a gun like you is a natural-born magnet for trouble. Figure I'll stick to you and get me my share.
I don't mind. Glad to have you.